Welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the U.S. Supreme Court rejects President Trump's bid to end DACA. The Salt Lake City Council makes some modest changes to funding for police. And despite the persistent increase in coronavirus cases, Utah moves toward a full-blown economic recovery. On the phone for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Thanks for joining, Tommy. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Reporter Leah Larson is with us as well. Good morning and welcome to you, Leah.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for being here. And reporter Sean P. Means, welcome to you, Sean.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can always tweet to us as well. Our handle is at KCPW. We will start today with our pandemic reality and the rate of new coronavirus cases in the state of Utah. And Sean P. Means, I wonder if you might just give us the lay of the land on that, because Utah is in the midst of a weeks-long increase in cases, a spike in cases. What is the data there?
Well, I mean, Dr. Angela Dunn, the state's epidemiologist, said it on Wednesday that we are at a higher risk for COVID-19 than we ever have been before in Utah. Yesterday, the numbers came in, and there were 495 cases, new cases of corona in the previous day, and that is 22 straight days where it's been more than 200 cases a day. And before that streak started, there was only one day over 200 the entire pandemic. So definitely more is happening. Yesterday, 495 was the second highest day we've had. The first highest was on June 6th, and it was like 546. And that day was largely attributed to the numbers that were coming in from the JBS beef plant up in Hiram. Hmm. There's no such single thing that we can point to right now, according to Dr. Dunn. There's no one major breakout somewhere. There's no beef plant. There's no one nursing home, anything like that. It's just that a lot of this is happening since the reopening, since Memorial Day, and as the state has been gradually reopening, they expected more cases and they're getting more cases.
I mean, they expected them and they're getting them. You spoke with a spokesperson for the Salt Lake County Health Department, and Salt Lake is looking at yesterday's data alone. That accounts for more than half of the new cases that we're seeing in the state is here in Salt Lake County. And as you said, there's no single event to explain that. You spoke with a Salt Lake County Health Department spokesperson, and he had basically an explanation for this increase in the county. And I mean, is it that people are complacent or that they aren't taking this seriously? What does he say?
Certainly the Salt Lake County Health Department thinks, people are not taking this seriously. And remember, Salt Lake City, the city itself, is still in the so-called orange or moderate risk category. Most of the rest of the state is in yellow, except for Kane County currently is in the green, so-called new normal. And as of 1 o'clock this afternoon, 9 more rural counties are going into the green area. Those counties, as my colleague Robert Gerke did the count yesterday, those counties account for an entirety of 60 cases since the pandemic began. In those rural counties, I mean, social distancing is sort of a natural phenomenon.
Right.
They've been doing it for decades. So there haven't been a lot of cases in those counties, and a couple of counties haven't had any. But for Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, for the more populated, more densely populated areas, you're in yellow or you're in orange, and there are people who act like, okay, it's done. We've weathered the storm. We're done. We can go back to living our lives. And the health officials will remind you, no, we're not. There is still work to be done, and everybody from Governor Herbert on down says, wear your masks, social distance where you can, and stay home if you have to. And there are health officials that we've talked to have been a little flummoxed that people are, not really heeding it anymore. They think that the worst is over.
I want to get to the economic component of the story in just a second, Sean. But and again, I mean, you're pointing out that we are just beginning to see the worst of the virus. That basically, this is an ongoing spike. It's not like we're a second wave or anything. This is just the increase in the wave of the pandemic. And the virus is spread person to person. And I want to talk about the opening up of the economy and the new plan on that. But you said that the message from state leaders is stay vigilant, do your part, wear your masks, keep your distance. Another sort of detour in this part of the story is that and we talked about this last week briefly on the show, that John Huntsman Jr., the former governor who's trying to become governor again, that he tested positive for the virus. He says now that he's fully recovered, but now someone else close to him has tested positive. Can you just tell us this little sort of side plot in the story?
Right. On Thursday, on her Instagram feed, Mary Kay Huntsman, the former First Lady of Utah, announced that she had tested positive for coronavirus. And it's a simple matter of she was in a house with somebody who had it, and that being former Governor John Huntsman, which is pretty much the way most people do contract the coronavirus. They come into contact with somebody else who does. It is... You have to wonder if it is that difficult for, the Huntsman family to assume, to self-quarantine and protect each other. Imagine, a typical family of four in a three-bedroom house. They will have the same problems. And if one person in the family gets it, odds are quite good that is for as much wiping down with Clorox and everything else that you can do in a house. If one person gets in the house, pretty much everybody likely will.
On John Huntsman's being fully recovered, that's a quick turnaround. We've heard about these lingering symptoms for some people. I mean, is he jumping the gun saying that he's fully recovered, or is I guess we just have to take his word at it.
Well, there's no reason to doubt him. I mean, he's not the youngest person in the world, but certainly he's healthy and generally healthy person. If you saw the TV debate the other day, he looked fine. He looked like he was doing okay. I'm not his doctor. I'm not going to be able to, to speculate beyond that.
Sure.
But we have seen cases. We have seen some cases where, two days of being in bed feeling like crud, and then you're over the worst of it, and then you're back to semi-normal. We've had cases where people were on respirators for 2 or 3 weeks. The disease hits people different ways.
Right. Again, 495 new cases yesterday, part of this ongoing spike. And I think you reported that 100 Salt Lake County residents have died now, Sean.
The Salt Lake County hit that milestone yesterday with its 100th death, 100th person in Salt Lake County who's died. And as the state health the county health department made the comment, one of the reasons for that is that there is a higher concentration in Salt Lake County of nursing homes, of long-term care facilities. And we have seen that a lot of the cases and a lot of fatalities are people who live in those facilities.
Yesterday, a former Tribune web manager, Rich Kane, on social media pointed out that on Wednesday, the coronavirus dashboard at the health department's website said, "It's working, Utah, stay strong." And then by yesterday, the "it's working" part had been removed and the homepage just read, "Stay strong, Utah." And I guess that's because it's not working. Sean, despite the fact that we're seeing this wave of cases, the state is going full speed ahead with a plan to kickstart the economy and trying to get people back into business and into businesses. A new version of the economic recovery plan that came out just recently. What's in this new plan?
Well, before we get to the plan, I think the point needs to be made is that it has been working. That the 3 months of lockdown or shutdown or, you know, voluntary lockdown, I suppose would be a better way to put it, had been working, and it had been, to use that overwork phrase, flattening the curve. Mm-hmm. And the point of the flattening the curve wasn't necessarily we're not going to get people sick. It's that we're that if people do get sick, it'll happen at a more sort of moderated rate so that the hospitals can handle it.
Right.
So that the hospitals aren't overwhelmed, and that has worked. And you hear Dr. Dunn at the State Department of Health or other health experts say we did that we have been able to keep the hospitalization at a level where there's not more people than beds. Now the question is, can we continue to do that? And the level of hospitalizations has been up, but it is still within what the state sees as the parameters of being able to, you know, to handle that caseload. Getting to your question about the Utah leads together four. This is the latest economic recovery plan that the Governor Herbert has come out with. Utah leads together four. They're like Led Zeppelin albums. They don't have names. They have numbers. This one is very ambitious, and it is trying to look at what a post-COVID Utah will look like. It's broken down into sort of three levels as far as a 100-day plan, a 250-day plan, and a 500-day plan. The first part, the 100 days, is sort of basically getting everybody who had to close back open at some level or another, still with new rules and regulations as far as social distancing, mask wearing, all the hygienic recommendations the state has been making all along, and the Chamber of Commerce, Salt Lake Chamber, wants to put up signage to sort of certify this business is following all the rules, that sort of thing. And the idea is that you get those businesses back going. The people that have been unemployed because of the coronavirus will get back to work. Will get back to work at the places they had been furloughed and all that. That's 100 days. 250 days, one of the main things is shovel-ready infrastructure projects. The state will borrow against its good credit rating and set up roads and bridges and whatnot that can be done rather quickly and put people to work in those fields. 500 days is sort of what do we want a new economy to look like? And it's very tech-driven. It's very cyber-driven. And that's more long-term down the road. The governor presented this somewhat yesterday in the first session of Congress, or sorry, the first session of legislature,
right.
The special session. And a lot of it is going to depend on whether the state has the money to back this up. And the legislature has been going over the budgets and seeing how much they can cut, how much they can take from the rainy day funds. And that's going to that will be an ongoing process.
That 100 days plan that however many 250 days and then 500 days, is that 100 days from the day that the plan was released?
Pretty much, but I mean, you know, it's variable.
Okay. And as you said, the governor...
My colleague Tony Samrad is the real expert on that side of it, but...
I will direct people to the sltrib.com website to get the details on that. And, you know, we don't have a columnist on the show because I uninvited Robert Gerke. And Gerke, if you're listening, I'm sorry about that. But, you know, 800 Americans a day are dying because of this virus. We're seeing this ongoing spike in the state of Utah. The virus, as you said, is spread person to person largely. And I'm just wondering, you know, by further opening things up, aren't we going to put more people in closer proximity to other people? And I'm wondering, and maybe this isn't something you can answer and that Tony Samrad can answer, but what is the exact calculus that's being done by state leaders? I guess the question I'm asking is, why are we opening up more if we're only beginning to see the worst
right.
of the pandemic?
Well, the argument that the state will give you, that Governor Herbert will give you, is that keeping the economy closed is causing a damage of its own that could be as bad as what the virus is doing. That is very much open for debate and a question above my pay grade. But the idea of in this newest plan that the Utah Leads Together for, one of the points that the governor makes is that we are sort of moving from flattening the curve to what he refers to as protecting the hive. That as the state reopens, as businesses reopen, there needs to be focus on keeping those groups that are at higher risk of worse outcomes from the coronavirus.
Yeah.
When we say people, groups that are at higher risk, we don't mean they're more likely to catch the virus.
Right.
Anybody can get sneezed on. The higher risk groups are the ones who, if they do catch the virus, worse things will happen to them. I mean, they're younger, stronger people. They catch the virus, they're in bed a couple of days, then they're over it. These high risk groups, they catch the virus, they could be in hospital much longer. They could possibly die from it.
Right.
The idea is to protect those groups, to work to set up things with the healthcare system to make sure that those groups are protected as well. That's Governor Herbert, in this plan, is trying to make the case that you can do both. You can open up the economy so people have jobs, people can be working, but at the same time, protect these people, protect this other group of people who, are at higher risk of bad outcomes they catch the virus.
Sean, we're going to have to head to a break here in just a minute. I'll point out that state epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn said that, among the high-risk group are people with underlying health conditions, and it turns out that, half of us, whether we know it or not, have underlying health conditions. And it's an interesting sort of dynamic that I guess everybody has to consider as we work towards moving the economy along, I guess. Sean P. Means is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Sean, I hope we can come back to you at the end of the show and talk about some of the actions the legislature took on things like emergency funding or the continued response to the pandemic and a few other things. But for now, I'll just say thanks for this. We need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will turn to some reporting on a Supreme Court case over the fate of DACA. This is Behind the Headlines on KCBW and Utah Public Radio. Back in just a minute.
Support for Project Resilience programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you in part by our members and USU Center for Persons with Disabilities, working to create healthy, inclusive communities through innovative research, service, technical assistance, and education. Information at cpd.usu.edu.
If you haven't had a chance yet to pick up one of the 2020 UPR Art Contest mugs, you have another opportunity to do so this Saturday, June 20th. We'll be holding a special one-day drive as we close out our fiscal year. You've helped us raise 90% of our membership fundraising goal this spring, and now we need your help to make up that last 10%. Your support makes everything you hear possible, so please join us this Saturday, June 20th, in support of trustworthy and factual news. You can give at upr.org, and while you're there, don't forget to claim a UPR mug to add to your collection, and thanks.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr and reporters Leah Larson and Sean P. Means. It is our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or tweet to us at KCPW. We will go to Thomas Burr in Washington now for news that broke with a Supreme Court decision over an Obama-era program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program. And Tommy, for someone who, whose only source of news is this weekly news roundup, remind us what this story is here, and then we can turn to Utah reactions. What happened?
Sure, thanks. It's not been a good week at the Supreme Court for the Trump administration. So the Supreme Court ruled yesterday a 5-4 decision. Chief Justice Roberts penned the opinion. He joined the liberals on the court to rule that it wasn't necessarily on whether DACA is legal, whether what the President Obama did when he was in office to protect the young immigrants who came to the country as children. The ruling was essentially on Trump's effort to get rid of the program. And the court ruled that it was essentially arbitrary and capricious, that the Trump administration didn't have the right rationale, didn't actually, you know, do the right reviews to end the program. In the end, it's a temporary victory. A lot of people cheered it, and a lot of people are very excited that the Supreme Court would rule this way. But it's not a permanent fix. It essentially said Trump couldn't end it this way. That doesn't mean Trump can't end it another way. And that there's a lot of people who are very, very excited about it, and a lot of calls for action, because really what needs to happen to make this permanent is for Congress to act. And there's the only way to do this is a legislative fix, essentially, that this can be you know, back and forth between administrations, Republicans and Democrats, if it isn't fixed in law.
Okay, so the court not making a decision on whether or not this program, which has provided temporary protection for deportation for around 700,000 people who were brought to the United States as children, also giving them access to work legally in the United States. The court is not saying whether or not that program itself is legal. It's saying that how the Trump administration rescinded it was done improperly.
You got it.
Okay.
And obviously, this in some ways, Trump hated the ruling, of course, but in some ways it's kind of a victory for him in some ways, too, because he doesn't have to then deal with, had the court ruled the other way, then you have 750,000, 700,000, you know, people who have grown up in America and then have to deal with, what do we do with them? Do you, like, all of a sudden kick out somebody who's only known America and only speaks English back to a country they've never actually been to? As much as he hated the ruling, it does elevate it to become an election year issue, but it doesn't put it back into Trump's court necessarily of what to do.
How did Utah's delegate? I mean, what kinds of reactions were offered by Utah elected officials to this decision, Tommy? A few lauded it, correct, according to your article. Some not happy about it. Everyone's saying, though, that, as you just pointed out, Congress needs to act. What sorts of reactions did Utah political leaders have to this?
Yeah. I think the most interesting one was Congressman John Curtis, who represents the third district in Utah, and he said, you know, this is a black eye, a black mark on Congress, and his point is, this is what happens when Congress doesn't do anything. And Congress has tried for, as long as I've been here, to try to pass some meaningful immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform, and every time it's failed. And his point is, if we keep passing the buck and don't actually do anything, then this is the kind of ruling we're going to get, which, again, is temporary. Former Senator Orrin Hatch, who actually was the first sponsor of the thing called the DREAM Act, which would have, you know, essentially given these kids who are now adults, a path to citizenship in some form, and protected them. Hatch sponsored this act back in 2001 and was very supportive until he faced a very tough re-election, and then he was not so supportive. But he came out with statements essentially saying the same thing: Congress needs to do something, that we can't just keep trying to do this administratively and wait for the courts to rule, that there needs to be action. And Senators Mike Lee and Mitt Romney were both kind of not necessarily. Mike Lee saw it as a victory. He saw in the ruling some language that the court was saying that DACA is illegal. Again, that was not necessarily the full ruling yesterday. Was not on the legality of the program. But he sees this as Congress again needs to step up. Senator Mitt Romney, again, not really commenting on the decision at all, just saying, yeah, we got to fix this. So this is one of those things we always see. Congress loves to hate itself. They say, we're bad for, we should act. And it's like, well, you are the people who are the ones who need to act. Whether actually anything gets done is the next question.
Right. Who are you railing against? The people that, I mean, you are the legislative body. you pointed out that Senator Orrin Hatch's original plan, the DREAM Act, would have provided a pathway to citizenship for many of the young or the immigrants who were brought here as kids. DACA doesn't do that. I guess, I'm going to read a tweet here, somebody tweeting to us their comments on this. This is Hammy Dakota says, the sad part of the, and echoing, this is echoing Mike Lee's language, the sad part of the illegal ruling on DACA, the court has no real jurisdiction in this ruling. It's up to the House to make that call. Roberts is wrong on his decision. and that undermines the law, the very reason why a reform is needed to remove lifetime position from the Supreme Court, is the takeaway of this person who's tweeting to us. And again, you can add your own comments by tweeting to @KCPW. Tommy, you know, back in November here on KCPW, we did a show on DACA when oral arguments were being heard. And at the time, the Mexican consulate here in Salt Lake City was hosting a DACA renewal event. So I went there and spoke to some Utah DACA recipients. And what struck me about many of them was how few of them had ties to the country their parents had brought them from. And I want to play just a few of their voices right now. These are some of the Utah recipients of DACA who I spoke to back in November for the KCPW program in the Hive. Take a quick listen and we'll come back.
Celine.
Celine. And how old are you?
I'm 24. I've had this status since 2013, so 7 years now, 6, 7 years. It has given me the opportunity to go to college. I'm now in nursing school, pursuing a degree in nursing. I currently work in a pediatric hospital. So it's really helped me grow educationally and economically. It gives me the opportunity to provide for myself.
Hillary, I'm 33.
How old were you when you arrived in the United States, and where from?
Yeah, so I'm from Mexico, okay, yeah. And I was 9 years old.
9 years.
Yeah.
What has DACA meant to you?
It's completely changed the quality of life. I went from not being able to, you know, have a good paying job to having a good job, you know, where I can use the skills that I have and the education that I have. So it's really made a difference in the quality of life.
Brian Aguirre. It's benefited me in a lot of different places in my life. Or like, I've been here for the longest time. You know, I grew up here. This is my home. This is all I know. Like, if I was to get sent to Mexico, and I wouldn't know nothing. You know, I could speak it, but I can't write it, and I can't really read it too much. You know, if you was to ask me anything about Mexican history, I couldn't answer that. But if you were to ask me anything about American or United States or just world history, I could give you probably dates. You know.
So I won't ask you your name, but can I ask how old you are?
I'm 24.
And how long have you had this status?
This will be the third time I'm renewing it.
How important has it been to you having DACA?
It's just a new door to opportunities.
Can I ask you what the country of origin would be for you?
Yeah.
Mexico, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it would be Mexico. And it would be scary because I came to the United States when I was 3. So I have no family there and really, like, nothing in Mexico. So.
And you came up through the school system here in Utah?
Yes, in Utah, my whole life.
How old were you when you first got here?
I was 3 years old. I would describe this as my home because the fact that I've been living here most of my life, this is basically all I know.
Yeah, so right now I'm just trying to get my contractor's license and open my own construction company, but I'm going to start barber school December 3rd, and I just finished my first course for college in business.
I wish I could help my parents, but I can't, so I'm doing the best I can so I can, like, help them too.
I mean, what would, like, it going away look like for you? I mean, what happens if it goes away?
We would just go back into the shadows, you know? We wouldn't be able to work. Even if we try, it would be very, very, very hard now to be able to have someone to actually hire you. And if we were to able to find someone, they would probably be very underpaid. And so we wouldn't be able to sustain a living, even just basic needs.
Can I ask how old you were when you were brought to the United States?
I was 7 years old. Yes.
And you've been in Utah this whole time?
Yeah, I've been in Utah this whole time. I've gotten to travel to a couple states, but yeah, I've been in Utah. And I think it's just great to work. There's a lot of people that are willing to work and earn a decent living. And I think that's all that matters.
So again, some Utah DACA recipients interviewed in November, and Thomas Burr there in Washington. Just going back to the court's decision yesterday, you know, what does it mean for this program? Obviously, it means that the DACA recipients can go on working, and they're not going to have to, you know, fear being deported in the meantime. And can new applicants come on?
You know, I actually don't know the answer to that, but I
don't think the Trump administration is going to be very favorable to that. The answer is it's still in limbo. There's no legislative fix. So for right now, we're still talking about, for right now, you can feel safe, but that doesn't mean, say, you know, President Trump gets reelected. What happens in January? They come back with something else if Congress doesn't step in. And just because you played that clip, I wanted to add Congressman Ben McAdams, Utah's only Democrat in Congress, made an interesting point yesterday in his statement. You know, he's like, you know, the individuals known as dreamers are our classmates, our coworkers, our neighbors, members of our congregations, kind of what Sean was talking about with, you know, people who will, you know, get sick from coronavirus. These aren't numbers. These are people.
Right. Okay, well, so obviously this is going to be a big issue for the November election. Is there anything else to add here, Tommy, or should we move on to some other news from this past week?
You know, I think it's just interesting to look at the court. John Roberts was appointed by George Bush, of course, made Chief Justice, and was thought of as this, you know, kind of rabid conservative. He's turned out to be, in some ways, a friend of the liberals on the court when it comes to some of the rulings on Obamacare, this one on LGBTQ rights. So we're going to see, it's going to be interesting to watch. President Trump's already taking aim at the court. If he gets reelected, he's going to make a new list of people he wants to put on there.
All right. Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, thanks for this reporting. We will now go. I'm going to remind listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us, our handle being at KCPW. We'll turn now to Leah Larson, who has been patiently waiting on the phone, and thanks very much for your patience, Leah. We will spend basically the remainder of the show tackling two stories that you covered this week, and both have to do with the sort of summer of protest that we are living through. I want to start with the story of the Salt Lake City Council, which has been hearing demands from activists to defund the city's police department. And maybe before we get to the action that the council took, can you tell us what is meant when protesters and activists and other citizens talk about defunding the police?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the answer might depend on who you ask. Some people want funding cut off completely to the department. But a lot of people, as these comments have come out in public meetings, the number they seem to have landed on for the Salt Lake Department is $30 million.
And do you know why they came up with that number? Like, that's a very specific amount of money that they want the budget of the police to be reduced by. Was there a sort of driving rationale for that amount of money?
You know, I don't know where that number came from. Okay. When I saw it, my mind instantly went to 2013. That brings the police department budget close to where it was in 2013. Council Chair Chris Wharton did say at one meeting that the figure may have been connected with a figure that came up in Minneapolis where George Floyd died. They came up with some kind of calculation, and they maybe used the calculation in Salt Lake City but scaled it to the size of the city, but I'm not sure.
Okay. The city and the police department, they say that $30 million would mean a number of employees of the police department would lose their jobs, right?
Yeah, and the number I've heard is around 200 officers. Of course, a lot of the people calling for this cut, that's exactly what they want. They want fewer officers.
Right.
So,
right, and that's the council, again, as we said, we'll circle back to the main brunt of the story here. They voted on a budget this week, and before they did that, they heard from, you know, still more residents asking for a reduction in the police budget. And including, you know, people saying exactly what you just said, that they'd like to see a reduction in police presence, in actual numbers of officers. Did the city council, you know, do a significant reallocation of funds out of the police department? Did they cut funding there?
You know, I think if you ask council members, they would say that they made a significant step. Of course, they plan to do more. But ultimately, what they landed on was $2.8 million, which is going to go into a holding account, and then they're going to evaluate the department further. They're going to form a commission. A commission on race equity to sort of evaluate the department and give them recommendations.
Right.
And then they'll decide what to do with that $2.8 million. And in addition to that, they have moved $2.5 million out of the department that funds social workers and put it into a different department but those social workers still work for the police department, so I'm not sure there will be any visible changes as far as the department's concerned, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You mentioned that the council is going to have an external, you know, third party who comes in and looks at the budget to see, you know, whether further cuts could be made without, impacting public safety. Who do we know much about what that review will look like? Who will do that? Or is it just, you know, that this is a plan that they have?
The way I heard it described is that, so they already have some like third party auditors contracted. So they're going to go to them and ask them to come up with a plan. And I guess it's called like a zero sum budget. So they're going to sort of pick apart the police department budget line item by line item, and then kind of explain it to the council in a way that, you know, helps them better grasp like where all the money is going and whether the council members can make further cuts without unintended consequences to public safety.
This is obviously in response to what we've been seeing around the country and the protests and the calls for police. Well, in some instances, reform, sometimes defunding, sometimes, you know, some activists are calling for, I guess you said, the abolishing of the police. How are police officials responding to the first off, just this initial cut, and then the idea that their budget's going to be under scrutiny and that they might see further cuts?
I haven't heard much response. I know when the council was discussing this in one of their work sessions, Chief Mike Brown was listening in, and he came on and just said that he had been listening and appreciated the careful thought they were putting into it. Of course, the police department is concerned about that full $30 million in cuts because of the impact it would have on the workforce. Most of their money budgeted goes to personnel.
And then there's money in the budget that has to do with body cameras and further funding body cameras in the Salt Lake City Police Department. Can you talk about that aspect of the budget?
Yeah. So the council had already budgeted about $500,000 to get more body cameras on police. But this year they're discussing their budget. The fiscal year begins on July 1st. So they've been talking about it a lot the last month. They made it a priority to outfit everybody who works for the department with a body camera. And in addition to that, they want to implement some sort of technology that when, you know, an officer gets out of their vehicle, it will automatically turn on the body camera. Right. So that's about $1 million-ish more than they had initially proposed. So pretty significant funding there.
I talked to Chief Brown about that a little bit for a program this week on KCBW in the Hive, and he said also that, conceivably it could be that when anyone draws their surface weapon or their taser, that would activate the body camera as well and would activate the body cameras of any nearby police officers. He talked about that being sort of good for transparency. There's also money for officer training. I mean, added money going into the police department for training. Can you talk about that, Leah?
Yeah. The council is setting aside a little bit more in training funding. There's $55,000 for de-escalation. That was implemented in the 2017 fiscal year, so they're continuing with that for this coming year. But they're also adding about $268,000 of non-departmental to get more enhanced training. They didn't call it de-escalation, just like enhanced training.
Sure. Just on the, and this is cursory or sort of in the periphery of this exact story, and I'm wondering, Leah, or maybe Sean P. Means, I'm not certain who of you can actually address this, but if you were following any of the action in the legislature yesterday, because there was some regulatory action on what police can and can't do. And Leah, if not, you maybe Sean Means could tackle this, but this is HB 5001, sponsored by Representative Sandra Hollins. Can either of you tell us what this bill did, Sean or Leah?
I could, if you like.
Okay.
Our colleagues, Bethany Rogers and Taylor Stevens, were covering this in the legislature special session yesterday. The bill that was passed through both houses, would ban police from using knee-on-neck chokeholds, which was the type of chokehold that you saw happen to George Floyd in Minneapolis in that horrific video. This was passed overwhelmingly, only five no votes in the House and unanimous approval in the Senate, and was pushed by Representative Sandra Hollins, who is the only black person in the state legislature right now. And it would ban law officers from using this particular procedure, where they would put a knee on someone's neck to subdue them. This is basically a good first start, a good start to it. The governor has issued an executive order trying to prohibit all types of chokeholds, and this bill would also, or there's also, I believe it's in this bill, to have the peace officers' standards and training academy, the post academy, where all Utah law officers get their training, to not train people how to do chokeholds in the future. But they have the legislature for yesterday stopped at doing an outright ban of all chokeholds. That may come up again in a future session.
All right. Thanks for covering that for us, Sean P. Means. Leah Larson, just on the city budget and the police department, is there anything else to add to this story? We actually need to head to a break here, but anything that we're missing from the story that you think ought to be touched on?
Well, I might just jump in to add that last week the Salt Lake City Department added a ban on those knee chokeholds to its own policy, as well as firing tear gas on crowds.
Okay. And that's right. That was part of changes to policy or I guess putting into ink policy at the Salt Lake City Police Department in the wake of protests after the killing of George Floyd. Okay, we're going to head to a quick break. When we come back, there's still more news from this past week in Utah. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Right now, Utah Public Radio is committed to helping you build up your resilience. Our Project Resilience program has tips on ways to relax, adjust to change, and turn to nature or the arts for mind and body bridging. Listen for our segments during Morning Edition and All Things Considered, or go to our website, upr.org, to learn more and link to our Project Resilience resources.
On the next Radio Lab, the story of an Algerian-German immigrant who moves to Venice and upends a 900-year-old tradition.
And then the trouble began.
The gondolier. That's on the next Radio Lab.
Tomorrow at noon here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Leah Larson, Thomas Burr, and Sean P. Means. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Before we left off, we were talking about the city council and police funding and some state regulatory action. I want to quickly, before we move on to the story of a protest over a police shooting in Salt Lake City, I want to ask about... you know what? I'm going to skip it. I'm going to skip the further digging into the legislative session because we are low on time. And so, Leah Larson, let's actually turn to a protest that you covered, a protest related to the death of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal, who was killed by Salt Lake City police. Footage of that came out in the midst of these police protests. Can you just remind us what the footage of this killing, of this police shooting shows, Leah?
Sure. So early in the morning of May 23rd, footage shows that police were chasing Palacios Carbajal for several blocks. They were telling him to show his hands. He at one point was stumbling. He dropped something. Police say he had a gun. And they ultimately shot at him more than 20 times. And according to body cam footage, it looked like he was running away from them as they shot.
And police say, as you said, police say that a gun was found nearby him. Protesters, you know, they showed up at the Salt Lake County District Attorney's office, Sim Gill's office. They were there last night. They were there Wednesday night. What are they asking for? You know, obviously justice, but what do they want from the district attorney?
Great question. So the district attorney, Sim Gill, received a report from the Unified Police Department. They investigated the shooting and they turned over their findings to Gill's office on Tuesday at 3 p.m. So these protesters want him to release the findings as quickly as possible. And in a conversation I had with the district attorney, he said he is planning on doing this as quickly as possible, given the public interest. And he's thinking about 2 weeks.
And I mean, there's a sort of background history. There have been other police shootings. The district attorney comes in, and he is basically responsible for determining whether or not the police were legally justified in carrying out the action that they carried out, where they shot and killed somebody. And that's something that protesters point to as being something that they're not necessarily happy with the district attorney about, right?
Oh yeah, I think in 2018, listeners, you might want to fact check me on that. But Corey Balgord was shot by police after they mistook his cell phone for a weapon, and so that went to the district attorney, and he ruled that there were no charges to be filed because the police did believe that he had a gun. That's what they thought at the time, so he did not bring any charges. And certainly people that are showing up to these protests for Palacios, Carbajal, are also bringing up shootings like that, also showing out in support of that and wanting more justice done there.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think it was late 2018 that happened. And then, as you said, Gill determined in 2019 that officers were legally justified in the shooting. And you report that it's basically... you know, the legal threshold that the police have to show is that they feared that they were, you know, that they were in fear for their life or something along those lines. I might be misstating that myself, Leah. Can you give us a sense of what that legal threshold is?
You know, I think you're right there. I think that they just have to, if the police officers believe that they needed deadly force in the moment, then they can be ruled as justified. So if they believe that Bellegarde had a gun and they were just their lives were at risk, then they were justified in shooting him.
In terms of the report that or the investigation that is in the hands of District Attorney Sim Gill, what's the sort of time frame again on that, on when that might be publicly released?
He told me he's hoping 2 weeks from now.
Okay.
He has to do his own investigation. And he expects it to take about 2 weeks.
Okay. And Leah, is there anything that we are missing from the story? We actually should turn in a moment to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. But in terms of, you know, the overall picture of police protests and, you know, what they're trying to get accomplished, some reforms happening, I guess, but protests continue?
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay. That's Leah Larson, a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And at this moment, it's time for us to turn to the final segment in the show, our underplayed stories of the week. And we left out a couple of stories that we had intended to get to, and I'm sorry about that. But we will turn now to Thomas Burr in Washington, D.C. Tommy, what have you got for a pick for underplayed story of the week?
You know, I don't know if it's underplayed, but it won't be on Sunday. President Trump's going back to doing his rallies. He's been, you know, pretty much shut down and left the White House for quite a while. And so on Saturday, he's going to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And while everyone's saying, you know, please let's physically distance ourselves from each other, let's wear masks, he's going to put 19,000 people into a stadium, into an arena, and have a rally. So we'll kind of see a little bit more of the unhinged version, I think, where he's not scripted and he gets to go back to saying what he'd like to say.
Okay, so President Trump going back to, I guess, campaigning is the way you would put it, and that's Tommy Burr's pick for underplayed story of the week. Sean P. Means, what is your pick for underplayed story?
Well, I mean, first off,
Definitely check out Bethany Rogers and Taylor Stevens' coverage of yesterday's special session of the legislature. It was a long agenda, and they hit all of it. So check that out. But I'll go to Courtney Tanner. My colleague had a story this week, continuing from a previous week, about this Weber State professor, a political science professor named Scott Senjo, who had resigned from Weber State after some tweets and social media posts were unearthed of his, saying some pretty harsh, nasty things about street protesters. And the Weber State thought, okay, well, that's done, we're over. Well, no, because of tenure rules, Professor Senjo rescinded his resignation, and he is still on the employ of Weber State University. So whatever PR nightmare the Weber State thought they were clear of, they are not, and they will continue to have fights about whether or not this professor will be fired or allowed to teach students or whatever. So,
all right, and you can find that reporting. It's Bethany and Taylor Stevens at sltrib.com.
Mm-hmm. And Courtney Tanner's on the Weber State.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for clarifying that. I apologize. Let's go to Leah Larson. And Leah, do you have a pick for Unemployed Story of the Week?
Well, today is Juneteenth, the day that we marked the end of slavery in the U.S. On 1865, in this day, the last enslaved people were liberated in Texas. So Scott D. Pierce put together a list of events and things going on today and tomorrow to celebrate it virtually and from a safe social distance. So I recommend checking that out.
All right. A Juneteenth celebration, guide at sltrib.com from Scott Pierce. Check that out. For my part, I'm going to go with a story by Kathy Stevenson that is about the fact that Utah can restaurants and bars in Utah have been given in some cities this variance to go out and operate in parking lots or in public right-of-way in some instances if they get permission from the city. One question that was lingering over all of that was whether or not the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control would allow them to serve alcohol in those spaces. And Kathy Stevenson's article published in the Tribune this morning says, yeah, that liquor officials say that it will allow alcohol to be served on makeshift patios, for example, but there will be a few restrictions and different boxes they need to tick, including obtaining written permission from the respective city, getting liability insurance, and dispensing alcohol inside of the establishment, not on the patio. There's a variety of different sort of measures they have to meet, but if bars and restaurants are going to open up in a somewhat safe manner, they need to be able to have people safely distanced and preferably outside. And that's maybe going to help them do that. So that's my pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Leah Larson, Sean P. Means, and Thomas Burr, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. I really appreciate your spending the hour with me. Thanks.
Thank you.
Happy to do it.
Thanks very much, Sean. You have been listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. It's a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. Thanks very much to our operations director, Jesse Ellis, and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a nice weekend, and join us again next Friday.
Utah Public Radio and Bridgeland Audubon Society are excited to present the Grow Native for Birds Bookmark Art Contest. All of Utah's wild birds rely on native plants in the wild and in our parks and gardens. And this artist contest celebrates the beauty of this interdependence and connectedness. From now until September 4th, we'll be accepting submissions, and then you'll get to vote on your favorite design. The winning design will be printed on an educational bookmark that will be distributed to Utah libraries, local fourth graders, and online available for anyone to view and download. For more details, go to upr.org. And to submit, just send your submissions to katie.swain@usu.edu. Celebrate nature and art.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, KUSU, FM, Logan. Also heard at upr.org.